Welcome to The Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. Just how far will a grieving mother go to right a tragic wrong? It is the question asked in Alison Galen's new thriller, The Collective. Camille Gardner is a grieving and angry mother who, 5 years after her daughter's death, is still obsessed with the privileged young man she believes to be responsible. When her rash actions draw the attention of a secret group of women, The Collective, Camille is drawn into a dark web where these mothers share their wildly different stories of loss as well as their desire for justice in a world where privilege denies accountability. Alison Galen has been nominated for the Edgar Award 4 times, most recently for her thriller If I Die Tonight. Again, the new novel is The Collective, and it's a great pleasure to welcome Alison Galen to this week's book show. Thank you so much for being here. What a great pleasure.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
It's a real delight to have you. What brought you to this particular story about really the lengths a mother will go?
Well, I'm a mother myself, and I keep up with the news. I'm kind of a news junkie, and I've heard so many stories across the board about people who are, you know, everybody from Gabby Petito to, you know, lesser known cases where somebody will die a horrible death and the killer will somehow go unpunished. And my thoughts immediately go to the parents. So I like to write about the things that scare me the most. And whenever I think, how would I feel if I were in that situation? I kind of know that it's something that I want to write about. So I just wanted to sort of explore those feelings that a parent might have when both the justice system and life in general seems to have let them down.
So you very much tell this story about grief and obsession and, of course, rage, which I'd like to talk about and get into in a second. Before we go that far, though, give us a sense of the story that you tell here and what brings us to that point.
Okay, well, the story centers around this character, Camille Gardner. She is basically a shell of a person. 5 years ago, her only daughter was basically killed. She was at a frat party. She was raped and left to die in the woods. The boy who Camille believes responsible did go to trial, was acquitted, and went on to live his best life. In fact, at the beginning of the book, he's winning a humanitarian award. Camille, on the other hand, is, as I said, sort of the shell of what she once was. She's barely surviving. She is consumed by, as you said, rage and grief. And all she wants is to see this boy go punished. She acts out in a public way, and there's a video that goes viral. And as a result, she's discovered by a group of women on the dark web, all mothers, all who have lost their children to killers who one way or another went unpunished, felt they were let down by the system. And they may or may not be taking justice into their own hands.
One of the fascinating things I found about the novel is that you really dig in where most novels either leave off or you get to in the middle after the crime. But you really start there with what is left of the pieces that are scattered all over for these families.
Yes, exactly. It's just sort of about the aftermath. I mean, that's always the thing that sort of fascinates me as a crime writer, are those who are left behind, those who have to deal with it, the ripple effect of a crime and the devastation that it causes.
Talk to us a little bit about Emily Gardner and why so important in the story as to how the other characters relate.
Well, Emily is Camille's daughter.
Yep.
And she's a typical 15-year-old girl in a lot of ways. I'm the mother of a daughter. My daughter's 20 years old right now. You know, around 15, they start to kind of come into their own and have lives of their own that you might not know about. So when something horrible like this happens to her, Camille spends a lot of time sort of second-guessing the way she was as a mother, the way she might have raised Emily, whether in some way Emily did something that caused her own murder. Not that she would be to blame, but all these negative feelings sort of go through her mind. And the loss of Emily, the lack of Emily, is just sort of what drives Camille in her life.
The thing here, too, is that it is years, really, before the person who that Emily identifies as the person who killed her is acquitted.
Yes.
And that is really, I mean, there's a lot of ways to say it, but that's the icing on the cake of say, okay, enough. And what is it about that? Because I think one of the things that took me really, that is so interesting is just how long and agonizing that 5 years must have been.
Yes, exactly. And everything happens to Camille in that, right. In those 5 years, she loses
right.
her marriage. She's
yeah.
just sort of barely surviving. She's kind of, she loses a large portion of her body weight. She's just sort of a shell of what she once was. But I think, you know, the wheels of justice supposedly turn slowly, but in this case, and in her mind, they didn't turn at all. He was acquitted in this trial. He, you know, claimed that the relations between them were consensual and that what happened to Emily happened long after they sort of lost track of each other at this party. And because he had these sort of expensive lawyers and was from a wealthy family, he, you know, was acquitted. He was exonerated, which I think is probably even more upsetting
right.
to Camille, that it just feels like there's no guilt. There's no feelings of guilt on their part. And
enter the character Luke. Tell us about Luke and the connection with Camille and ultimately what he does here.
Well, Luke is Camille's only friend at this point, and they have a really interesting connection. He contacted her because he was the recipient of her daughter's heart. And so even her only friendship, even her only sort of escape from this world is deeply connected to her daughter. And it's might seem kind of strange, but in times of stress, she listens. He allows her to listen to her daughter's heartbeat in his chest.
Sure.
So in a way, he's sort of partially filled the void in her life that Camille once, I mean, that that Emily once filled for her. It's a very not unconventional friendship, but it is, you know.
And oh, by the way, he's an actor.
Yeah, he's an actor and he plays a cop on TV, which is, I guess it's sort of ironic.
Because that's, you know, that's a good friend to have,
yeah, exactly.
I suppose, barring a real cop that can help you solve the crime at hand.
Exactly.
Allison Galen is our guest. The name of the new book is The Collective. It is published by William Morrow. One of the things that is fascinating, and you write about this, of how many people say throughout this process to Camille, well, it's just time to move on. It's time to, you got to move on. Let's go. Come on. You're spending too much time on this. You have to move on. I don't know how you could say that to a person.
Yeah. And in fact, that's the appeal of the collective of this group that she meets online and later
right.
on the dark web is the one thing that's forbidden for them to say within this group is move on. Everything happens for a reason. That's another phrase that Camille hates. And by the way, that I hate, because there are a lot of things that don't happen for perfectly good reasons. Yeah, I think the whole concept of moving on, though, is the only way you can survive this type of thing. But when other people, I believe, tell you to move on when you've been in this situation, it's very easy for those feelings of rage to increase even more. You know, I think Camille feels that they have no right to tell her
right.
to move on, to get out of their way, to stop them from feeling uncomfortable around her.
And then there's a point in talk, because there's a moment where Greek mythology enters into this. And I found that fascinating, your choice in that. What brought you there? I mean, obviously it makes sense, but it also must be an interest as well.
Yeah, well, I mean, there's something really, I love to write noir fiction, and there's something very noir about Greek drama, particularly Greek tragedy. In many ways, I think the collective themselves serve as a Greek chorus, sort of reinforcing those feelings of rage and grief and wailing along with the main character, kind of forming this group together. The book starts with the epigraph is a quote from Medea. You know, hate is a bottomless cup. I will pour and pour. I found as I went throughout the book that Greek drama just kept coming more and more into it. It was kind of organic in a way. And the initial group, Facebook group that Camille joins that leads her to the collective on the dark web is called Niobe, who is the original grieving mother who turns to stone as the result of her grief.
Let us talk about that for a moment, because this is a Facebook group that starts as a way for her to deal with her grief, but then it goes from grief to anger and then to the aforementioned rage.
Yeah.
And that's where this collective is born. So tell us about how that is birthed.
Yeah, so Niobe is kind of the gateway drug in a way. It's kind of like the little path that you go through to go down that rabbit hole. After Camille is in this very public situation where she's raging at this boy who's receiving a humanitarian award, she's briefly arrested. And when she's outside the police station, she's approached by a woman who saw her calling this guy a murderer in public and hands her a card. And the card just says Niobe. And Camille doesn't know who Niobe is, but then she finds out that she was a woman who showed too much pride in her children in Greek mythology, and who was later, who had her 12 children were killed by Apollo and Artemis in punishment for her pride and has turned to stone as a result of grief. So Niobe turns out to be a Facebook group full of women who have lost their children unfairly in the same way. And there is no insistence on moving on within this group, but there's also there it doesn't quite have the same rage. And when she rages on this page, when she posts writes a post about what she went through as a mother and how furious she is and how she doesn't want to move on, then she kind of gets this invitation to join this group on the dark web very surreptitiously. And that's when she meets these women who echo her feelings and who really are like a Greek chorus for each other. They all, it all feels like an elaborate role play. They're all talking about inventive ways they want these people responsible for their children's death to die. And no one is telling anybody to move on. Everybody is just reinforcing it. But the Facebook group is kind of the gateway to that.
It is the gateway. It is also where, as you say, this anger starts to gather. One of the things that I found fascinating about your writing in the book is that we feel that anger start to ramp up. And I'm just wondering what that was like to write as you start to get your hackles up and say, okay, I've gone from grief to something needs to be done here.
Yeah, I really felt it as I was writing it. And I don't know if a lot of it has to do with writing a lot of it during the pandemic. I think there was a feeling of powerlessness and a feeling of not knowing what's going to happen next that resulted in, kind of a subliminal rage for a lot of us, including those of us who were writing books at the time. So I feel like that found its way in. It was the scariest book I've ever written, I feel, because I sort of realized these things within myself as I was writing it, this type of rage. I mean, I definitely felt it as I was writing these scenes. I think it's a scary book to read, and it was really a scary book for me to write.
It is a scary book to read. It's because of these revenge fantasies, and you understand why they want that. You understand why they are seeking that revenge. All of them, what they do have in common is they have all lost someone and have not seen justice, have not seen they either acquittal or whatever. They have not seen the justice that they feel.
Yeah.
Which brings you, the reader, to the question of, okay, but who's should they be making that decision?
Yeah, exactly. And that's something that, I mean, it's interesting because I've had other people ask me too, during interviews, do you feel that, why do you feel that revenge is the right way to go? That's not how I feel. I'm exploring just those feelings that people might have, and how it makes you sort of lose sight of everything else, especially when it's echoed. I mean, I always say about the book too. I mean, what do you want to say with the book? Well, one is that there's a very fine line between justice and vigilantism, and the other is that, you know, beware of like-minded individuals that you meet online.
Good words, no matter what the topic you're talking about. Allison Galen is our guest. The name of the new novel is The Collective. One of the things when we talk about that is that the idea of, yes, revenge, but also, is there redemption? Is there something that that person can do and pay their debt to society? If you have committed that act, are you truly evil? Mm-hmm. Is there an evil moment, or is that an evil person? You sort of bring all of those questions to light.
Yeah, absolutely. Because it's all human beings. Everybody is I feel that there are very few wholly bad or wholly good people in this world. We are all mixtures of it, and it's sort of whatever we want to kind of present. But I feel like when you're in a mindset like this, you tend to zero in on that person that caused all your misery and view them as wholly bad, no matter what type of a life or what happened, what led up to it. Anything, and you view them in this sort of way of, if I were to just eliminate this person, if I were to make them feel how I feel right now and then end them, then I could finally get some peace. Is that true? I don't know. I mean, I don't think there are a lot of people finding peace within the book, but
I mean, this goes back to the Bible of an eye for an eye, right?
Yeah, exactly. And it's in there because that is the emotion that you feel. You want to take somebody else's eye if they take yours.
Yes.
So, weird analogy, but
no, absolutely.
You do. You want them to feel the way you do. But is that right?
Is that going to bring you the peace and the resolution or the acceptance of grief that you are ultimately seeking? Is it going to stop that rage?
Right, exactly, because your child is still gone.
Right. There, and I don't want to give too much away here, but there is a real price that has to be paid for these women going ahead and having their fantasies come true.
Yes, absolutely.
And that has to be weighed in this, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. There's a huge price to it. And also something that I think is explored in it a bit, and something that I thought about when writing it, is, okay, well, what happens when you do get that revenge? What are you living for now? What's driving you now? What's making you go from day to day? You still have the loss and you still have the grief. But the person causing you that rage, which has been your driving force, is gone. You know, I mean, that's something that would come to mind within this type of scenario. Is your life suddenly happy and wonderful?
Yeah.
No, you still have this giant hole in your life.
We were touching on it a moment ago when we were talking about Facebook, and you were saying, you know, one of the things you may learn is not to take one of these friend requests. But you do certainly address social media and that echo chamber, and it seems like you have quite a bit to say on it, and it's fascinating because this is obviously it's extreme, but it's a very plausible thought of how one could get very easily involved in a group that they would not otherwise get involved in.
Yeah, it's a real, I think it can be a real echo chamber too, and it gets worse and worse. And one of the things I was doing, I mean, a lot of people have asked me if I actually went on the dark web. Well, I didn't. I'm kind of afraid of malware and things, but I did research on the dark web.
I don't know how you get on the dark web.
You need an unencrypted server. And
oh, okay.
Like
all right.
Long
all right.
But I talked to an expert about it, and I felt like that was enough. But But I did look at a lot of these message boards, 4chan, 8chan. These, right. These are the places where QAnon was born. And QAnon, it makes sense that QAnon was born on a message board like that, because everyone just echoes each other and outdoes each other and says the most horrifying things and then get validated for it because everybody's thinking the same way and there's nobody coming up against them going, hey, wait, that's a little harsh. You know, it gets worse and worse and it kind of snowballs. I couldn't stay on those boards for very long. And here I'm writing a whole book right. about people who meet like minds and serve as this sort of kind of almost become this entity together, this one big hateful entity that's all sort of fueling each other, strengthening each other's opinions, not having any dissent. You know, it's a little terrifying.
Another part of it too that you're writing about, which at the time you were writing about, I think was very natural that many of us were having a national discussion about the legal system and great concern and distrust mm-hmm. with the legal system that we were seeing. I'm not putting words in your mouth, but I am asking it as a question of did that play a role as you were writing it just because of the timing?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And in fact, you know, some of the cases that I had in there, I sort of tried to temper and change a little bit so it wouldn't sound too much like a diatribe. But yeah, I mean, it is the legal system is imperfect, right? And so we all feel the effects by that. And privilege has a lot to do with who gets punished and who doesn't get punished. You know, other things I mentioned there don't even have to do with the legal system, but perhaps, you know, a doctor who commits malpractice, but, you know, is well off enough and supported enough that he doesn't really, you know, lose much as a result, whereas you've lost your child, you know. There is a lot of inequity within the legal system, and it results in a lot of people who might not be as well off as other people not mm-hmm. getting the justice that they deserve. So, yeah.
And this goes back to the beginning of ultimately the question is how far will a mother go to right a tragic wrong? And that really is at the bottom of this, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, definitely.
And the answer is really far.
Yeah, very far, I would think. You know, whenever I see parents on the news who have lost children in these horrible ways, I'm, you know, yeah, I just, it's how far I would go really far. I mean, think most anybody, yeah.
And Camille continues to go back to that point with living with the fact that her daughter was given alcohol, she's taken into the woods, she's raped, she's left to fend for herself. It's cold, it's a bitter, horrible night, and by the time she's found, she's suffering from exposure. So that just gets, you replay that over and over and over again.
Yeah, and I think a lot of it, in Camille's case, there's a guilt that she was working late that night.
Right.
In her husband's case, he let her go to this party. I mean, there are so many things where you think, what if I had gotten there? What if I had told her she couldn't go? What if I had found her 2 hours earlier? What did I do wrong? There's that comes into play as well. So,
well, Allison, we can't continue talking about this book without at least me asking you. There are twists. There is a twisted ending that, wow. So how soon was that in the equation when you started writing this?
A part of it was in the equation when I first started.
Okay.
I knew what had to happen at the end. How I got there, I came across later in my writing process, and I added things in a rewrite and everything. But the actual end and the reason why it happened, that was there from the beginning. And that just sort of had a lot to do with my own exploration of the topic.
And knowing where you're going, that helps you. Obviously, that helps you get there.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And also allows that you to give the rage a certain degree as you move forward.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. You know, a lot of it is sort of how well do we really know our, how objective are we about ourselves?
Okay, so let me ask it this way.
Yeah.
You know you're going to have the twist ending.
Yeah.
At what point do you start consciously laying the breadcrumbs to say, okay, this is where I'm going down this road?
Well, from the beginning a little bit, but I actually, when I went all the way through it, I write notoriously horrible first drafts, and I feel sorry for my agent and my editor because I think they're just terrible. My pacing is off, everything's off. And so in my second draft, I really consciously went through it and thought, how can I sort of seed this in here without going over the top, but it needed to be seeded in a little more. It couldn't
right.
come out of nowhere. So a lot of it I really saved for the rewrite. I think the first time it really felt like it came way out of left field. It's like, oh, come on, you know. But when I went through the rewrite, I tried to seed in it a little bit more.
It's fascinating. I don't think I've talked to an author about this before, but it does seem to me that it would be very difficult because you don't want to make it obvious.
Yeah.
You don't want to make it so outlandish that nobody even buys it.
Yeah.
You want to make it believable, but also nobody saw it coming.
Yeah, exactly. It's really hard to do that. So that's a lot of reason why I leave enough room when I'm writing a book so I can surprise myself when I'm writing it, especially in the first draft. So even if I know what the final action that I want to happen in the end, the last few things leading up to it are usually kind of a surprise to me. And so that's, I'm like, well, if I'm surprised, then a reader would be surprised, you know. But yeah, it's pretty tricky.
Do the words come out and you look down and say, oh, that's where we're going?
Sometimes. Yeah. Sometimes with some things. Those are the wonderful days.
Bad days are when you look down and there's nothing there.
Why am I here? Where am I gone? What is wrong with me? That happens more often.
Allison Galen's new novel is The Collective. It is published by Morrow. We enjoy hearing from our listeners about our shows. You can email us at book@wamc.org. You can listen again to this or find past book shows via podcast or at wamc.org. Sarah LeDuc produces our program. Bookmark us for next week. And thanks for listening for The Book Show. I'm Joe Donahue.